Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Bear Stearns. It was the first of several Wall Street banks to fall in 2008, and it led to the global financial crisis. 10 years later, we unpack all the forces that led to this crisis, and our host will ask whether we are at risk of a repetition. We're joined by William Cohen. He's a former investment banker and author of the book House of Cards. That's a chronicle of the Bear Stearns collapse. And joining him is David Wessel, former economics editor at the Wall Street Journal and now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Moderating this program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This program is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
And gentlemen, great to have you with us this hour. William Cohen, for people who were maybe collateral damage, people who were passive witnesses, people who were experiencing this through newspaper and TV coverage, let's go back 10 years. What was Bear Stearns?
Well, Bear Stearns was one of the five premier investment banks in this country, founded in the 1920s, was basically almost 90 years old, had never had a losing quarter in its history. It had been public since 1986, and was one of the leading underwriters of mortgage-backed securities, had a huge fixed income division, and was sort of known as a swashbuckling, kind of irreverent Wall Street firm, not quite as blue chip as Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, therefore always looking to get an advantage, be scrappier, and had a habit of making a lot of money.
Who were its customers?
I mean, it had many of the same customers that all firms had. It didn't have quite as many corporate blue chip customers. It had a lot of hedge fund customers, had a lot of trading counterparts, did a lot of work with media and technology and real estate companies. I think even occasionally dabbled with Donald Trump. So, I mean, it was part of the second tier, I would say, of Wall Street investment banks, but, you know, very successful, made a lot of money, made a lot of people very wealthy, and, you know, played an important role on Wall Street.
David Wessel, so much has happened since then, so I feel like we have to sort of fill in the picture before we turn our gaze forward. Was this an era when a lot of new financial products were being created? And what is a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation?
Well, the short answer to your question is yes. We had an explosion of innovation and financial engineering on Wall Street, and much of it had to do with ways to take something as simple as a mortgage, combine it with other mortgages, and slice and dice it so you could buy the risky part or you could buy the part that was supposed to be less risky. And they would sell them to different sets of people. So someone who wanted something less risky would get the thing that was supposed to be safe and would pay a little less interest. And someone who wanted to be more of a gambler would get something that was more risky with the understanding I'll get paid a higher return, but if things go wrong, it might not pay off.
Generally speaking, were they telling the truth? Were the risky ones risky and the not risky ones not risky?
I think they were generally telling the truth about some were more risky than others. But what people didn't understand, whether the salesman knew or not, Bill may have views on that, it turns out that the things that were said to be not risky were very risky. People didn't understand the risks they were taking, and they didn't anticipate something that actually a lot of people didn't anticipate. Alan Greenspan once said was impossible, a nationwide decline in house prices.
So, William Cohen, where did the problem emerge? I mean, if you were buying devices that were not opaque and honest about what they were, where did the trouble start?
Well, David makes a very good point in that the peddlers on Wall Street, whether they knew it or not, they had actually created products that were extremely risky, ironically able to sell off the riskiest pieces of the stack of securities to investors around the world, and were forced to retain what they perceived to be the less risky part on their balance sheets. And so what that resulted in, again, without most of them knowing, and I put Goldman Sachs in a little bit of a different category because I think they were better at risk assessment than every other firm on Wall Street. But I think what really it came down to, Ray, was a problem of perverted incentives. In other words, people on Wall Street were rewarded to take big risks with other people's money. They were rewarded to package up mortgages that should never have been made in the first place and turn them into mortgage-backed securities and sell them to investors all over the world. And they got rewarded by big bonuses for doing that and bringing in the fees related to selling those securities. And then what nobody, I think, anticipated, or very few on Wall Street anticipated, because this is not the way Wall Street bankers and traders' minds are wired, is to understand the way Wall Street financed itself. So that was a very big mistake. And it remains, by the way, a very big flaw and mistake. And they financed themselves by securitizing or using as collateral for short-term loans the very pieces of the mortgage-backed securities that they couldn't sell that they thought may not be that risky. They used them as collateral for short-term overnight loans. So as an example, Bear Stearns had around $18 billion in cash sloshing around through its bank in March of 2008, 10 years ago. But it needed around $72 billion a day to run its business. So it borrowed the rest of that money that it needed in what was called the short-term overnight repo market, which is a fancy way of saying a short-term loan that would be made collateralized by assets on Bear Stearns' balance sheet. And what happened in that week of March of 2008, 10 years ago, was that the people who had been providing those overnight loans without thinking very much decided that they didn't like the collateral that Bear Stearns was providing them anymore, and they decided to pull the plug on providing that financing. And therefore, literally, Bear Stearns ran out of money. So it's a combination of the way Bear Stearns and other Wall Street firms finance themselves, which is still going on, and the perverse incentives that Wall Street rewarded its bankers and traders with to encourage them to do things that were risky without perceiving the risks. And that, too, has not changed. So both of the reasons, in my judgment, that caused the financial crisis 10 years ago, neither one has changed.
David Wessel, there were people inside Bear Stearns who knew what was up. A year before the firm began to unravel, bond traders told Bear Stearns hedge fund managers to write down the values of two funds, the high-grade structured credit strategies fund and its brother fund, the enhanced leverage fund, and they didn't do it. I mean, there were people who saw the cracks and yet did not take action. Did that make what eventually happened worse? Could prudent early action have changed the trajectory of this story?
Well, the answer to that has to be yes. It's a little bit like there's some tremors. And some people say, this is going to be an earthquake and we're going to have a tsunami, so you should flee. And other people, many of them, quote, experts, say, nah, this is just kind of a mild tremor, don't flee. After the fact, you know who you should have listened to. So yes, you can identify people who warned of things, but you can always identify people. There are people who say that because of all the things that happened because of the crisis, we should be having hyperinflation now, and we don't. So it's definitely the case that none of us were vigilant enough. I don't think, as Bill Cohen says, we fully understood, especially people like me on the outside, how complicated and how interconnected everything was. So it was really a house of cards. And even if you knew a little bit about the risks that your firm was taking and you felt uncomfortable about that, there weren't very many people who had the imagination to see that if Bear Stearns got in trouble, that would lead to a series of events that created the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression.
But we're talking about what had been historically a fairly regulated environment. William Cohen earlier referred to Bear Stearns as a swashbuckling firm, but there were limits on how much you could buckle your swash. There was some set of rules that governed the operation of these banks. When people inside Bear Stearns knew the problems and their extent, Bill, were they required by existing laws to say something about it to somebody else, or could they just pass on the garbage?
Well, unfortunately, in the years leading up to the financial crisis, we were in a period of what was called light touch regulation, and I think you get the meaning of that. Basically, the SEC and the Fed, and there were other regulatory agencies responsible for monitoring what happened on Wall Street. But basically, it was a hands-off regime. George W. Bush, much like Donald Trump today, is sort of taking the approach that, you know, maybe less regulation is better. So that meant that, surprisingly, there was never any SEC auditors in Bear Stearns. The Fed never showed up. Again, very different today. It allowed Bear Stearns to have a huge amount of leverage on its balance sheet, as much as 50-1, meaning that there were 50 times the number of assets as the equity that Bear Stearns had, meaning that a 2% change in the value of those assets could wipe out the value of Bear Stearns' equity account. And of course, that is precisely what did happen 10 years ago. So, unfortunately, it's sort of like, you can drive on the Taconic. The speed limit is, 80, not 55. You can wear your seatbelt if you want to. You don't have to. We're not going to pull you over if you're not wearing your seatbelt. If you want to have a few drinks before you go driving, that's fine, too. So I think that was the notion of regulation in the years leading up to the financial crisis. And, of course, Wall Street is expert at knowing exactly where the lines are and getting right up close next to them and doing everything they can that is, quote unquote, perceived to be, legal so that they can, take as much risk as they possibly can. I think another major failure in the years leading up to the financial crisis is that Wall Street executives did not understand, did not appreciate, did not perceive the risks that were embedded in their firms' activities, in their firms' balance sheets. And that obviously was devastating.
And one of the things that people find frustrating is you wish you could find some one person to blame. And the problem is, and I think what's overwhelming is, how many of the supposed checks and balances failed to check. Not only did the regulators fall down on the job, the risk management committees at these big firms were more about risk and less about management. And we could spend an hour talking about the failures of the rating agencies that were stamping AAA, these securities are safe, on things that proved not to be safe. So what's remarkable about this episode is how few people saw it coming, and how few people who did see it coming did anything about it, and how many people were either corrupt or ignorant in this process.
But a lot of people had a lot of skin in the game. Yes, the risk was widely distributed to the corners of the earth, but also there were a lot of people right there in lower Manhattan who stood to lose a huge amount of money. So I mentioned earlier the warning from the bond traders in April 2007. In May, the Enhanced Leverage Fund lost 18% of its value, which is one thing for a stock, but for a bond, that's panic time. Investors started pulling out their money, and Bear Stearns had to start selling assets in order to pay that obligation. Did the alarm bells go off even then?
I mean, yes, certain alarm bells went off inside those two Bear Stearns hedge funds. But Ray, you have to understand, those two Bear Stearns hedge funds, which amounted to about $1.5 billion, had been every month since their start for like 40 months or so profitable. They had been in the net positive a return category. And only till around February of 2007 were they beginning to see cracks. And then, as you point out correctly, the funds started losing a lot of money. Investors wanted their money back. The funds were then gated, i.e., Bear Stearns hedge fund managers decided that Bear Stearns investors could not take their money out. Then there were lawsuits started to try to get out that money. And then what happened, again, based on the plumbing, the way this hedge fund financed itself, was that there were calls, collateral calls on the assets that the hedge fund managers had used to buy more securities, and they were forced to sell assets to pay off the overnight short-term lenders. And a fatal decision was made in and around June of 2007 for Bear Stearns to replace all the other Wall Street financiers as the overnight lender to the hedge funds. And then when the funds were eventually liquidated a few weeks later, Bear Stearns took all of that collateral, which was rapidly losing value, all of those assets onto its own balance sheet. And that became part of the problem, which 6 months later resulted in a crisis at Bear Stearns. So there were flags along the way. You know, Bear Stearns by that point was so deep into it. And as I describe in the book House of Cards, because of what had happened at Long Term Capital Management and Bear Stearns' role in that, a hedge fund that nearly failed 10 years earlier, and the way that Bear Stearns had alienated the rest of the street in that process, Jimmy Cain, the CEO of Bear Stearns at that point, felt that he couldn't again alienate the rest of the street because they would stop doing business with Bear Stearns. So he decided to take out all of the other lenders to the hedge funds at 100 cents on the dollar, which was a fateful decision, making Bear Stearns itself the lender to the hedge funds. And then when they, as I said, liquidated all that collateral, all those assets came onto Bear Stearns' balance sheet. It was a fateful decision. Many at the firm told him not to do it, but he decided that he needed to do it to maintain Bear's reputation on Wall Street. And that, of course, was one of the main things that led to the demise of the firm.
While this is happening, while the market is passing judgment on these various securities, while people are panicky and starting to lose their shirts, something else happens, David Wessel. Your paper at the time, The Wall Street Journal, ran an article that said CEO James Cain, Jimmy Cain as Bill referred to him earlier, was spending a lot of his time playing bridge and smoking pot and not much time or not enough time running Bear Stearns. As I went through my notes at the time and as I recalled what I read in Bill's book, again, this was sort of a group delusion that even though there was a ton of smoke, there was still not enough fire. What was going on?
Two things are going on. One is it's pretty clear Bear Stearns is in trouble. That November 2007 story on their CEO didn't help. Jimmy Cain actually steps down a few months later in January 2008. By March 2008, Moody's is downgrading some of their mortgage-backed debt, and the thing is beginning to start to cascade. But at the same time, what's happening in the big picture? Well, housing prices are starting to fall, and there's a sense that there had been a bubble in house prices and that it's over. But we have the leaders of our economy, people like Ben Bernanke at the Fed and Hank Paulson at the Treasury, assuring us, in their words, that this is going to be contained. They saw that a lot of loans have been made to people who probably shouldn't have gotten the loans and weren't going to pay them back. But the subprime market, as it's called, was so small relative to all the other things in the economy, the stock market and stuff like that. They didn't think that this was kind of the beginnings of a virus that would nearly kill the patient. So again, when you look back, you say to yourself, how could we have been so stupid? Bear Stearns was not one canary in a coal mine, but like a whole flock of canaries singing. And yet we don't see that what's happening to Bear Stearns might soon happen to someone else, say Lehman Brothers or even Goldman Sachs or Merrill Lynch. Very few people saw that chain of events that was going to unfold. And they should have seen them.
The bonds were reduced. Bear Stearns bonds were reduced to junk bond status. Was starting to have a hard time raising money. Fourth quarter 07, lost $854 million, which must have gotten some attention after 80 years of straight profits. But there was a new CEO, William Cohen. The company still had a lot of cash. What happened in those ensuing weeks?
Ray, Wall Street is a confidence game. It only works if people believe that a company is not only solvent but vibrant, able to make markets, able to trade, able to underwrite securities, able to have the capital it needs. You know, in a fractional banking system, which we have, the money that we put into these banks is an illusion. It's never there. We think it's there. We hope it's there when we want it. But it's actually never there, because the way these banks make money is that they take the money that we give them, either through our deposits or loans or investments, whatever it is, and they then lend it out to other people and they capture the spread. That's banking. That's fractional banking. So the money is really never there. So when people begin to get worried, and more people begin to get worried that the money isn't there, they start panicking. That's what has caused almost every banking crisis in our nation's history and probably in the history of the world, is when everybody wants their money at the same time and they go to the bank and guess what? They discover that it was never there. It wasn't there. It isn't there. It was never there. It was never going to be there. And as long as everybody doesn't want it at the same time, that's fine. But when everybody wants it at the same time, they find that it's not there. That's what happened in the 29, 30, 31 time period, you saw these big lines around banks and the banks were closed and people couldn't get their money. The same thing happened this time, only in the institutional market, not in the retail market, because after the 1930s, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was created, and essentially now people's deposits are insured up to $250,000. What happened this time was that institutions, hedge funds, private equity firms, big mutual funds, people who had had their money at Bear Stearns, who had much more than $250,000 at Bear Stearns, realized that their money wasn't there, that Bear Stearns couldn't pay them back, that the collateral that they used to secure those loans wasn't money good. So basically, around the Ides of March, that week of March 10 years ago, despite the best efforts of the new CEO, Alan Schwartz, and despite Jim Cramer on Mad Money on CNBC telling people they'd be crazy to take their money out of Bear Stearns, it's like the greatest firm ever, basically there was a run on the bank. People lost confidence in Bear Stearns, and it happened virtually overnight. The unthinkable happened. I often describe, as David Wessel said before, this was a crisis of a lack of imagination. People could not possibly imagine that Bear Stearns would go down the tubes in a week after being in business for more than 80 years.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales. We're hearing from William Cohen. He's the former investment banker and the author of the book House of Cards. It's a chronicle of the Bear Stearns collapse. And joining him is David Wessel, former economics editor at the Wall Street Journal. He's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. During this broadcast, our listeners are experiencing our new format, and that is that I've invited Ray Suarez to join me as co-host of World Affairs. Ray is known to our listeners as the former chief national correspondent for PBS NewsHour. He was also anchor of NPR's Talk of the Nation. Ray is a great journalist. He's a good friend. And now back to our program and Ray Suarez.
At the heart of all this was the housing crisis and the intricacies of securities that were traded back and forth to the ends of the earth based on American mortgages. And during this time, yes, there was an increase in the number of people who weren't paying their mortgages or who couldn't pay their mortgages. But David Wessel, it never even got into the 80s. More than 90% of Americans were still paying their mortgages. and yet the securities that their mortgages backed lost 40, 50, 60% of their value. How could that happen? Most people were still paying their mortgages. These things became unsellable, even though everybody knew most people were still paying their mortgages.
Well, one thing that happens is more and more people, as this period goes on, have a mortgage that's greater than the value of their house. So while they're paying their mortgage today, if you're an investor and you're looking at a security and it's a package of mortgages, and a lot of the people have mortgages that are greater than the value of their house, you say, what are the odds that these people are not going to be able to pay back? Well, they're a lot higher than I thought there was. So there was a general sense, and an accurate one, that if house prices fell across the country, more of these things were going to be unpaid than people had expected. And that's what happens when people change their minds about something. And in this case, they were correct to change their minds. They didn't appreciate the risk they had taken, so the things were priced at one level. Suddenly it hits them, this is a lot riskier than I thought, and the world is a lot uglier than I expected, so the value of the bonds goes down. And, you know, there were a few people who took advantage of that. The Big Short, Michael Lewis's book, is a whole book about people who figured out how to make money they rode the escalator down and made a lot of money at it.
The syndrome that, Bill, you describe, of lines around the block and people panicking and all that. Anybody who's seen It's a Wonderful Life got a lesson in that from Jimmy Stewart, who explained to all the panicky people in the lobby of the building and loan that their money wasn't there. How come, even with that widespread knowledge, and we're not dealing with a bank where people in the neighborhood have their Christmas club and their Hanukkah club and their college savings account. We're dealing with seasoned pros in many cases. You used to be one. Holding your water might have made a lot of sense at that point, instead of trapping Bear Stearns into a position where it had to disburse large amounts of cash, while at the other end, nobody was lending it more money.
Well, you're acting as though you're expecting that perhaps investors will somehow get together and do what's in the interest of everyone collectively, so that somehow they won't all run for the exits at the same time, forcing.
But even their own interests.
No, Ray, because remember, these people are lending Bear Stearns money a day at a time. So all you have to do is say, I lent the money on Tuesday, I lent the money on Wednesday. On Thursday, I'm giving my money to Goldman Sachs because I think these guys might go under. And that does it. It's not, they don't actually have to pull their money out. They just have to avoid another one-day loan.
Exactly correct. And they decided that through the course of that week, the collateral that was securing those loans, those short-term overnight loans, wasn't worth what Bear Stearns said it was worth. And at the end, these overnight lenders wouldn't even take Bear Stearns' collection of U.S. Treasury securities as collateral. That's how scary people thought Bear Stearns' credit was. And there were all sorts of rumors along the way. You know, there was a rumor that Goldman Sachs basically, quote-unquote, wouldn't novate a Bear Stearns trade, which meant that they basically wouldn't take the other side of Bear Stearns' trade, meaning that they no longer thought that they were a solvent counterparty, a money good counterparty. That kind of information gets into the market very quickly and can result on the run on the bank. And one mystery that has never been solved, as far as I can tell, is that there were a number of people, hedge funds, I assume, making short-term bets that Bear Stearns' stock price would fall in less than a week, and putting up millions and millions of dollars to make that bet. And in fact, in March, they made these short-term puts. And in fact, that is exactly what happened. They ended up making a lot of money on that bet. Why they would risk that money, why they thought that was a good bet, is pretty astounding. And the SEC has never revealed who made those short-term puts. Some people think that hedge funds who had money with Bear Stearns pulled that money out and then began circulating rumors that Bear Stearns was going to fail at the same time that they had bought these short-term puts from which they made millions of dollars. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. It turns out that the market is actually very thin and illiquid in some securities, and you can manipulate it beyond your wildest dreams if you're smart enough.
David Wessel, I'm a career-length general assignment guy, not a specialist like you or Bill. And I was trying to understand the spectacle of senior administration officials, like the Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary Paulson, becoming basically a sales agent trying to get somebody to buy Bear Stearns. I didn't know whether something like this had ever happened before, but it seemed astounding that now we were at the point where government officials were casting around and pressuring big-time CEOs, hey, buy this thing, or else the jig is up. Had something like that ever happened before?
Well, in a sense, every time we have a bank failure, something like this goes on. When we have lots of bank failures over time, and what the government does is we'll take over the bank to pay off the depositors, and then we try and sell the assets and to someone else, and it's usually more orderly than this. What was unusual about, well, there were a couple of things unusual about this. One was, this was a, Bear Stearns wasn't one of the biggest firms on Wall Street, but it was pretty big. It isn't like the savings and loan in It's a Beautiful Life, and A Wonderful Life. And secondly, we had at the time a pretty rigorous system of regulating banks, commercial banks, the ones that have bank in their name, like Citibank. We did not have a very good system in place for regulating these investment banks like Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, and so forth. So there was a bit of, like, chaos because neither the Fed nor the Treasury really had been very, and Bill mentioned this earlier, had been very involved in overseeing Bear Stearns. They were supposed to be wards of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which has a very different approach. They didn't at the time look at themselves as responsible for the financial stability of the firm. They looked at themselves as the guardian of the consumers who bought the stuff. So they wanted to make sure that they weren't lying on their disclosures. So one of the reasons there was such chaos was that this was really something that the regulators hadn't had to deal with in a long time. A big non-bank financial firm going under at a time when the markets were a little shaky.
Let me just jump in and say that this, the federal rescue slash bailout slash organized sale of Bear Stearns was the first time that the federal government had ever jumped in to save an investment bank. In the other, whatever it is, 200 plus years of the republic, any other time an investment bank had failed. It was either liquidated or a merger was arranged privately, which happened plenty of times. But this was the first time that the Fed decided that Bear Stearns was too interconnected to fail, not too big to fail, too interconnected to fail. And so they decided that if Bear Stearns actually went into bankruptcy, which it was prepared to do on that Friday before the weekend on the Ides of March, that would have a domino effect on the rest of the financial sector. And of course, they were quite right about that. They therefore quickly arranged for people to come in and kick the tires at Bear Stearns. J.P. Morgan Chase, which had long thought about buying Bear Stearns, came in and scooped it up for $2 a share, and after a tense weekend of negotiations, ending up, people thought that was a fake number. People thought that somebody had left a zero off, that it was really $20 a share, which was astounding enough since it had been around $200 a share in January of 2007. And then because of some legal drafting errors, they ended up having to recut the deal at $10 a share. That became the template for the rest of the financial crisis. And in fact, Lehman Brothers, Dick Fuld at Lehman Brothers, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, kind of made the mistake of thinking that because the feds had bailed out Bear Stearns, they would also bail out Lehman Brothers. And that became a fatal error on his part.
All right, but it's important, and I know Bill knows this, Ray, is that J.P. Morgan refused to buy the firm unless the Fed basically took a lot of their
$30 billion
paper off. So the essentially the Federal Reserve, on behalf of the taxpayers of the United States, subsidized the purchase of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan. And some people think, I'm not one of them, but some people think that that was that precedent was so strong that people weren't worried enough as the year went on, and they were too complacent because they figured, well, if this firm goes under, the Fed will step in and bail them out. And of course, in September, they discovered that wasn't the case with Lehman and everything fell apart.
There are fascinating intricacies to this story. Paulson et al. Are breathing down Chase CEO Jamie Dimon's neck, asking him to buy this thing during that critical week. He asks for a couple of more days to do his research and eventually concludes that Bear Stearns as a company was worth less than the building it occupied in New York's financial district. As Bill mentioned, they dicker over the price. But interestingly, everybody was worried about the following Monday morning. Hank Paulson told Bear Stearns CEO Alan Schwartz the deal had to be done before the markets opened Monday morning. Bill Cohen, why?
Well, because if it hadn't happened before, you know, the markets obviously closed Friday at 4 o'clock, and then they start opening around the world, you know, on Monday morning. So there's a weekend where the markets are closed where theoretically no trading occurs, although there's all sorts of shadow trading going on. Therefore, the securities, Bear Stearns stock, couldn't fall. The bonds couldn't continue to deteriorate in price over the weekend, even though then in fact they may have continued to lose value. So it was important to send a message to the markets overall that Bear Stearns, which was prepared to file for bankruptcy on Friday, had been rescued by Monday. I mean, it makes perfect sense because the markets were closed, and it had the palliative effect, even though people couldn't believe the $2 a share price later increased to $10. The markets rebounded early the next week, there was a period of time. Lehman announced good earnings. People were announcing their earnings. Investment banks were announcing their earnings early to try to reassure investors. There was a sense that, okay, maybe Bear Stearns was just an isolated event. And, they're a swashbuckling firm, and they don't understand risk, and they're just all about greed. And so this possibly couldn't be as possibly interconnected as everybody thought, and this is all just going to be fine. And there was a period of time where people thought it might actually be fine.
If you're just joining us, this week marks the 10th anniversary, and boy, what a consequential 10 years it's been since Bear Stearns was forced in a fire sale to move onto the balance sheets of J.P. Morgan Chase. That's William Cohen, the author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, chronicling the Bear Stearns collapse. He joins me along with David Wessel, who's a senior fellow of economic studies at Brookings Institution, and the author of In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. And David Wessel, if this was meant, all of this stuff, to calm the waters, to reassure everybody and stop a runaway panic, it didn't work, did it?
Well, there was a period of calm, as Bill said, in the summer. The authorities managed to save Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the big mortgage lenders, without much of a hiccup. There was a lot of steam building in the pressure cooker. And while the authorities may have thought that they'd let off enough steam so it wouldn't explode, they were definitely wrong.
So what was the next chapter in this that gave everybody the signal that Bear Stearns was not an outlier, not a one-off, but the harbinger of worse to come?
Well, I think that as you get into September 2008, it becomes clear that Bear Stearns was not just an isolated case, and that Lehman was in trouble. Lehman is going through this very public, for what for as among people who know, Dance trying to find somebody to invest in them. And that leads up to the big crisis in the middle of September 2008, where Bank of America takes over Merrill Lynch. Lehman Brothers goes bankrupt with huge ripple effects, and the Fed then steps in and does an extraordinary takeover of AIG, the big insurance company. Some of the most remarkable days in American financial history, all of which happened back to back. And while this is happening, a whole lot of people are losing their houses. I mean, it's a mistake to think this is a drama playing out on Wall Street, and someone who lives in San Diego or Detroit is not affected by this. Because, A, there are all sorts of people, some of them overseas, as you said, who had bought these securities, who didn't know what they were doing. So there's problems in the German banking system, because to a very large extent, we sold lousy mortgages made in Dearborn to stupid bankers in Dusseldorf. And across the country, people who aren't paying their mortgages are getting running into trouble with foreclosures or threatened foreclosures. People who own houses are discovering they can't get a home equity loan or refinance their mortgage because it's not worth what they thought. So we're beginning to see the pain spread outside of just Wall Street and big money types who are playing cards with this money.
So it sounds like the threat remains of the gears of finance seizing up in a way that the bear rescue was meant to prevent. Is that right, William Cohen?
Financial panics are part of human nature, unfortunately. They've been around longer than Wall Street has been around, longer than America has been around. They are just part of life, and they seem to happen with stunning regularity. In the 19th century, it seemed to be every 20 years there was a financial panic. It's obviously been 10 years since this one. It was probably, the last one, I guess, before 2008 was in and around the internet bubble exploding in 1999, which followed right on the heels of long-term capital management. I mean, so I guess we're probably due for another one. They rarely repeat in the same way that the last one occurred. It usually happens in a way that we're not really focused on or prepared for. I think, again, when you have a system where the incentives are rewarding people to take big risks with other people's money, which is what happens on Wall Street, and you have a plumbing that relies on short-term financing at the same time that you're lending money out on a long-term basis, you have a mismatch of assets and liabilities, you are sort of asked, and the fact that in a fractional banking system, the money is never in the banks to begin with, as Jimmy Stewart pointed out, you're just asking inevitably for another financial crisis. And the question is, I think coming out of this last financial crisis, the regulatory pendulum swung very far towards more regulation. The banks are now, very fully capitalized, and to the point where they're complaining about having too much capital and not being able to deploy capital in the way they would like. And now you have a President Trump who's, couldn't be more eager to roll that all back. So where you went from being able to drive, 80 miles an hour without your seatbelt on the Taconic, with a few drinks, in the Obama era, everybody had to wear a seatbelt, no drunk driving, and 55 was the speed limit. Now Donald Trump is saying, wear your seatbelt if you want to, drive as fast as you like, and, we'll see what happens, unleash some of these animal spirits, and let's get this economic engine revved up again. And I think, frankly, the combination of that and a period of 10 years, and David Wessel would know this better than I, of the Fed's policies of keeping interest rates as low as possible has resulted in another era of mispricing risk. And I think we're kind of asking for it again, but it doesn't feel that way. It's like nobody, rings a bell when the market is about to collapse. So it seems like everything's great until the party ends. And then you realize just what the heck's going on.
I'm glad we got Bill on an optimistic note. Well, I think Bill, so yes, Bill is a characterization of what the Fed basically held interest rates at zero for a long time. They're still relatively low, historically speaking, because they thought that was necessary to get the economy back to where it is today with unemployment at a 17-year low and so forth. One side effect of that is when money is very cheap, people can take bigger risks. And people who want to make a certain return, whether it's an individual or a college endowment or a pension fund, in order to get a better return, because rates are so low, reach for yield, as it's called, and take bigger risks. So that's a balancing act. I think that Bill correctly points out that we did put in place a great deal of new regulation and new requirements on the financial system so that at least we won't immediately repeat the mistakes we made before. Demanding that the banks have much greater capital cushions so they're not as exposed as Bear Stearns was if they run into a bad time. Expanding the umbrella of regulation so you don't have these investment banks who really no one's regulated, and a variety of other things, I think have made the system stronger and more resilient. But we haven't tested it yet. We don't know what happens if we have a calamity next week, the combination of, you know, geopolitical risk and Trump's trade war, and maybe there's some idiot banker out there who made some bad bets and we have another set of problems. And so we hope that we've made the system strong enough to minimize the effect if there's another Bear Stearns. And we have new tools to deal with it. It won't be quite as much an ad hoc thing if a Bear Stearns fails again. Congress gave the FDIC and the Fed and the Treasury's powers to take over a firm like that, like they can take over a bank, which they didn't have before. But we won't really know if we did enough until we test the system with another crisis. And I hope it doesn't happen this afternoon.
During these same cluster of years, we had some of the mad cow disease panics, and the public realized that when they bought a pound of chuck at their local Piggly Wiggly or Albertsons or Vons, that the meat in that cellophane-wrapped pound of chuck didn't come from just one cow, but it may have come from half a dozen different cows. And people began to learn something new about the way food made it to the places they bought it. Similarly, these problems were not confined to one institution. If a place was being run in a risky, high-wire act way, because of the way people traded pieces of paper and owned pieces of each other, the contagion, in fact, was never limited to just one place. And instead of mutually assured destruction of that kind of cross-ownership bringing on probity and responsibility, it seemed to do the opposite because risk was distributed so widely that everybody was sort of counting on everything not collapsing at once. Did we learn any permanent lessons, William Cohen, from this, from what happened when Bear went down, from what happened when Lehman was allowed to fall instead of being repackaged and sold in a fire sale? Did we learn anything durable, or did we just think, oh, that was then, this is now, things are different?
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I just don't think, I mean, if the lesson really had been learned, then the CEOs of Wall Street firms would say, okay, we have a problem with the way we reward people at these firms for what they do. People are pretty simple. They do what they're rewarded to do. On Wall Street, they were rewarded to take big risks with other people's money. They are still rewarded to take big risks with other people's money. If we had learned a lesson, we would have decided on Wall Street that we can no longer, you know, finance ourselves in the short-term overnight markets and also lend on a long-term basis. And so there's a mismatch of assets and liabilities allowing for a potential run on the bank. Neither of those things has changed. People are still rewarded to take big risks with other people's money. It's still a bonus culture on Wall Street. People love to parade down to the corner office and tell their boss how many millions of, you know, this kind of security or that kind of deal that they did, then they deserve a big bonus for. Wall Street firms still finance themselves in the short-term markets because it's cheaper than long-term financing. People, as David and I were talking about, are, I think, mispricing risk and going for what I call the yield hunger games because of the Fed's zero interest rate policy for the last, 7 or 8 years prior to the recent step down of that. I think, frankly, we're clearly set up for another a problem in the financial markets, as we always tend to be. I mean, it's not like, I mean, the Federal Reserve was set up in 1913 to be a lender of last resort after some wise people, you know, got together on an island off the coast of Georgia and realized that J.P. Morgan, the man who had rescued the financial system in the 1890s and then in 1907, wasn't going to live forever, and they needed to have a lender of last resort. So in 2008, actually, the Fed did exactly what it was designed to do, despite the criticism that was leveled against the federal government. And I suspect, as David was saying, that we haven't tested this again in the last 10 years. When you know, people have all this talk about, oh, well, we're going to let Goldman Sachs fail, you know, whatever, we're not going to rescue these firms anymore. I guarantee you, nobody's going to let Goldman Sachs fail. The Fed will once again bail out Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or whoever if it comes to that. And so have we learned anything? I've learned a lot. I worked on Wall Street for 17 years. I had no idea how Wall Street financed itself. I've learned a lot about how risky the system is. And it's designed to be, frankly, and it's kind of a genius system when you think about it. But yes, it does. It is susceptible to panics and people all wanting their money at the same time, and that is human nature. When people all want their money at the same time, when it's not there, there's going to be a big problem.
I'm a little bit more optimistic, Bill. I mean, I'm sure he's right about the culture of Wall Street. He knows a lot more about than I do. But if you look at it from the regulatory side, we have done things to so we won't be caught so off guard again. I mean, the Fed had this system of looking at each bank individually and not really saying like, if every bank is making the same bet and that bet goes sour, the system could go down. We do force the banks now, and the banks now include people like Goldman Sachs, to do these stress tests, where they have to show the regulators how much capital would you have left if things go bad. These things aren't perfect. Believe me, I'm not arguing that we're really safe. But I think we have what we're trying to do is, if there is another problem, that it's less likely to spread throughout the whole system in a weekend than it was in 2008.
Is this as much a political question, how to respond to these things, what regulations to put into place, as it is a sound financial engineering question? Once you involve the Fed, once you involve the Secretary of the Treasury, once you involve the Congress trying to do oversight into the movement of money in this way, do you implicate regular people, those people who were losing their homes, those people who were underwater in their millions?
Yeah, of course, yes. It's inherently political in the sense that there's a lot of losses in the system, and one of the things that's going on is deciding who is going to take those losses. Is it going to be the bondholder at Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers? Is it going to be the shareholder of J.P. Morgan Chase? Is it going to be the homeowner who will be foreclosed on? Is it going to be the taxpayer who is kind of the pocket of last resort? And so, in the best sense of the word, it's political. So I think the answer is yes. It's not like treating a patient who has a kidney problem, where you can ignore all the social factors that may have led to this and ignore the fact that the guy was terrible to his wife. You're sitting there looking at the kidney and you fix it, and you figure if you're a doctor, someone else can worry about these other things. Well, in this kind of situation, in structuring a financial system, in responding to a crisis, It's inherently political. We're distributing losses. We're creating winners and losers. We're making judgments about what kind of risk we want to take on behalf of the whole society. It's very different.
David Wessel, you watched all this unfold from Washington. Is there a sense in the political class that this was money well spent? Yes, the U.S. government did things that it wasn't used to doing, but this was worth it, this extraordinary effort. Could there be entities someday, like Bear Stearns, that will cause a repeat of this kind of system failure?
Well, I think there are people who think huge mistakes were made to get us into this crisis. Some mistakes were made during the crisis. But on balance, the people who rescued the system prevented the Great Depression 2.0. And so there's a set of people, many of whom who work with me here at Brookings, who would applaud and say, the reason we're not in the Great Depression is because of the bailouts and all that. But I wouldn't say that's universal. There are a lot of people in America who think that Wall Street got bailed out and Main Street didn't. There are a lot of members of Congress who think this was crazy, that we created a lot of bad incentives by bailing people out. We wasted money. Wall Street made out. They're getting their bonuses, and my constituents are still suffering. And many of them are still fighting. You can hear criticisms of the Federal Reserve on the floor of Congress, that the same things you heard in 2008, even though 10 years have passed. So I would not say there's consensus of that. I think they did a pretty good job myself, but I wouldn't say that everybody agrees with me.
And I want to ask you both for a quick final thought on this. How can we prevent this from happening in the future? Or, in fact, can we prevent it from happening in the future? Are there legislative, regulatory safeguards that could insulate us from this sort of thing? David Wessel?
I think, as Bill has said, financial panics are not going to go away. The best we can do is try and make the system resilient. I think we've taken a number of steps in that direction. The risk here is that we're going to start dismantling them because people are forgetting how terrifying it was 10 years ago.
Bill Cohen, same question.
Yeah, I would agree with David. I think there's a way to refine some of the regulations that were put in during the Obama era as opposed to what seems to be happening now, which is just throwing them out wholesale. I also am a huge advocate of trying to redesign the compensation system on Wall Street so that people aren't rewarded without accountability for taking risks with other people's money. I think there are ways to do that. I've suggested a number of ways. Nobody on Wall Street seems to want to listen or take up that a mantle, which I think would be evidence of real leadership on Wall Street. And I think there's been, frankly, a vacuum of leadership on Wall Street because between the way Wall Street finances itself and the way Wall Street rewards its bankers and traders, there's real problems that need to be addressed and are best addressed by the CEOs and boards of directors of those firms.
That's William Cohen, author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. Bill, great to talk to you.
Thank you, Ray.
And I was also joined by David Wessel. He's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and author of In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. David, always good to talk to you.
You're welcome, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured William Cohen, former investment banker and author of the book House of Cards, and he was joined by David Wessel, former economics editor at the Wall Street Journal, now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And the program was moderated by Ray Suarez, co-host of World Affairs. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.